Thank you. Our first question is from Lou Caparelli of UniSuper. Please go ahead.
Oh, hi, Shane and team. I'm just curious, looking at your slideshow and the discussion on thermal coal exposure, I'm just curious to know, when you look at that, the wording you use seems significant where you refer to thermal coal mining. I'm assuming that your exposure to thermal coal businesses would be quite a bit larger than the $500 million or less than 0.05% if you were to include utilities, perhaps coal transporters, et cetera, and other service providers. So I'm just curious if you have any data on that. And then appreciate the example you raised in the annual report in relation to Wesfarmers. But I'm just wondering, like, Wesfarmers, you know, does have some challenges in making the sort of transition to a decarbonising world. Sorry about that. But I'm just wondering, you know, if you've had discussions or are, you know, involved with other companies for whom the decarbonisation task is more challenging. And I pick, for example, you know, the oil and gas companies to whom I suspect you'd have some significant exposure. Thanks.
Yep. Okay. Just on the thanks, Lewis. Mark here. Just on the coal exposures, I think slide 5 is probably what you're referring to. The thermal coal exposure EAD, that number that we have there, which is $500 million, is our direct exposure to thermal coal mines or thermal coal power generation. So you'll see that that's come down like 70% over the course of the last 5 years. That's our direct exposure, the stuff that is for companies that are purely, or projects that are purely thermal coal related. You're right though, there is a broader exposure that we have, which is around those companies that have diversified operations, of which includes thermal coal mining or potentially thermal coal fired power stations. Now, as you'll see in our changes, don't have those numbers here now, but as you'll see through what we're doing with regards to the policy changes, any companies, and there's very few of them now, that have over 50% of that diversified nature, or diversified exposures, including coal, we're looking to have almost a sinking lid approach to that, to get that to, asking them to get down to 25%, or else we'll be capping our exposures for existing companies. Any new debank, we will not onboard if they have any significant, and that's been defined as 10% diversified revenue in nature, I should say, sorry, if they have any exposure to thermal over 10%, then we won't be onboarding them because we're following general market rules with regards to that. So that hopefully covers that question.
Well, I'll just add something to that, Mark. I think the point here is the principle. We're not looking for loopholes here, right? We're just trying to, you know, as you can imagine, there's a lot of nuance and definitions and data points. So we're not trying to find loopholes in the policy, but we're trying to be really clear so we can publish data that's reliable. You know, the principle here is we will reduce our exposure to companies who work in the area of thermal coal. We will reduce that, yeah? But what we're trying to do is be really crisp so that we can give you data that's totally reliable, that we can sort of publish easily.
And we're conscious of the transition period for some customers into meeting some of these guidelines that we have for ourselves internally. Many of them are already heading down that road anyway. The ones that have got higher levels of coal exposure, we're finding in our discussions with them, already have in place transition plans to get that lower anyway. So we're sort of in line with what they're doing.
Appreciate that. And a lot of them, like the utility companies, you know, if you pick AGL, in addition to being, you know, Australia's largest emitter of thermal coal emissions, they're also Australia's largest investor in renewables. So it's a fraught area. I totally get that.
Sometimes a little hard, particularly the diversified nature of some of these customers, to actually get accurate data, by the way. Mm-hmm. So it does, but we continue to work with them. On the other issue, and on other customers, I mean, there is many of them. Wesfarmers is a good example, we feel, because they're taking a lead. But to your point, there's not a number of other customers that maybe have higher carbon footprints because they're in certain sectors. And I would say, though, the discussions that we're having have been pretty well received by them as well. Now, in 2 weeks' time, I'll be presenting to a major infrastructure company around what we're doing, why we're doing it, and that's been requested by them, not because they've got concerns per se, but it's because they want to learn from what we're doing and what we're hearing from other customers. So I think this is, you know, various companies are at different transition. Various companies have different levels of interest, but I think it's only growing because I think they understand the financial risks. So it's actually more broad than, say, some of the just normal industrial companies.
Okay, sorry, and my final point was around oil and gas extraction. I noticed in those slides on page 5 that oil and gas extraction is the biggest of your fossil fuel exposures, which is not uncommon for a lot of us operating with exposures to fossil fuels. And just how are your discussions there going with transition, given that most companies like to grow, but growing in an oil and gas
I think many are similar to what you just pointed out with regards to AGL. You know, we met with a couple of large oil companies when we were in Europe, and what surprised us there was the discussion that we went in wanting to understand a little bit more about what they were doing, and they were more progressed in their thinking on this than I'd anticipated, to be honest, and they were looking at what they could do to reduce their own carbon footprint on the oil side particularly. On the gas side of things, I would say the other thing that surprised us, particularly from the regulators in Europe, was that all of the regulators in Europe said to us they see gas as a transition energy source. And so I think that now I know a number of the NGOs won't necessarily agree with that, but
yeah,
they were taking a pragmatic approach to it.
Yeah, because that itself, referring to gas as a transition fuel, it's sort of it's getting harder and harder to defend that position as well.
It is, and you know, I suppose what we're looking at is what's the most pragmatic approach to working with these customers and what the community standards are, and as you would well understand, it's a hard road to navigate.
Yeah. All right. Thank you.
Thank you. Our next question is from Mike Harrit of ACSR. Please go ahead.
Thank you. So firstly, I'd like to just express our support for your efforts and disclosures this year on climate change, and I think also the openness to have these, you know, public forums. My question is on physical risk and insurance. So in the report, you mentioned the bank's losses from the tragic bushfires and how that was mitigated to a large degree by your customers' insurance policies. And you also mentioned, you know, future work around understanding the overlap between high physical risk exposure in your mortgage book and inadequate insurance. So longer term, do you see a risk of widespread unaffordability or even outright unavailability of insurance in highly exposed areas as the risk increases? And what are the implications of this for the loan exposure of banks, and how will it impact customers' ability to refinance?
Yeah, look, I'll give a philosophical answer, then I'll, you know, Jared or Catherine, one of our colleagues on the phone, may want to chip in, or Mark. It's a really good point. I don't know that there's a definitive answer to it, or what I can tell you is that the board, so I met with one of the world's largest reinsurers, actually, about a year ago, so it was pre-COVID. We had a really interesting discussion about this whole area, and, you know, they helpfully pointed out to me that, you know, they've been in the climate change business for over 100 years. That's, you know, mostly what weather related issues are. And so we arranged time with our board, which was 3 months ago. You know, obviously it was delayed due to COVID and that, but we did it on video. We actually had with our board exactly that conversation. You know, how do you think about insurance, the insurability of assets, whether they're homes, whether they're farms, whether they're power plant, whatever they might be. And how do you think about that risk? You know, I mean, it's interesting from our perspective as a bank, and again, I'm not shying away from it, but remember, you know, the average tenor of our exposures is quite short. You know, even a mortgage, the average life of a mortgage is 4.5 years, even though we might write them longer. So it is something we've been very conscious of. We've actually engaged with that insurance company to have a more meaningful dialogue to try and understand that risk. And actually, you know, I think there's opportunity for us, which is how do we help our customers think through some of that? Are there more innovative, better solutions for customers on that? But it's a real risk. But I don't know, Jared or Catherine, if you have any, Catherine, do you have any perspective on that, how we think about it from a risk perspective?
Thanks, Shane. I think acknowledging that it is a concern, I think one way to respond to that is to recognise that the Australian Sustainable Finance Initiative is addressing or looking to address exactly some of that and connecting the insurance world with the banking world, with the investor world. So I'm happy to take it offline and have a separate conversation with the caller and talk about some of the recommendations that are going to come out around that, if that helps. But yes, certainly I think ASFI provides a forum in which the banking industry can participate with the insurance industry to address these concerns.
And I mean, one little comment on it. I mean, one of the things that we've learned from the last few years is really, and we mentioned a bit in our results, is the power of data. And if you contrast the difference between the insurance industry and the banking industry, I mean, the insurance industry is always, you know, you think about when you insure your own home or whatever asset, the level of detail they get on your asset, where it is, which side of the road, you know, all that sort of stuff. You know, we've never really had that level of sophistication because we haven't needed to. But I think, you know, with the way that big data, the power of big data, the way that the cost of that has come down, and we've learned so much through COVID actually about actually the ability we do have to analyse some of those risks and get a better understanding is quite powerful.
Yes, no, thanks for that. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks,
Mike. Thank you. A reminder to ask a question, please press star then one. Our next question comes from Alison Ewings of Redman. Please go ahead.
Thank you. I should start by saying I've got far fewer questions following the release of the disclosures yesterday than I probably had this time yesterday morning. So I'll probably take that as a compliment. But I did wonder if you could share some additional detail on how the progress to date on decarbonisation has been achieved, so to the extent to which that's happened as a result of the transition activities of existing customers or exiting customers or strategic decisions about what business to chase, or a rough indication of what the relative combination has been. And I guess more forward looking, to what extent you are already thinking about the potential for more nuanced positions with respect to oil and gas in particular, building on the earlier
question. So I'll take it on again. I'm sure Catherine and others might have a point of view. It's a good question. So look, if I stand back and think about what are we trying to achieve here, well, you know, we see this as a risk management issue, right? And the reason we're engaging with our customers, we're basically saying, you know, clearly there's an issue here. Clearly the risk profile on climate change is rising. And if our customers who are emitting don't get that and don't have mitigation plans and don't have a transition plan, well, it sort of indicates they sort of don't really know what they're doing. And so that would just, you know, there's all sorts of red alarms that go off on that. So we haven't taken a prescriptive, while we've got some prescriptive approach here about exposures, you know, we won't expect this person or that industry or et cetera. In terms of the transition plans, we really just want to engage in conversations with these customers and walk through how are they thinking about it. You know, how are they thinking about mitigation? What is their transition plan? How are they thinking about diversification? All those other bits and pieces. So we're learning through that ourselves. Now, what we have said is that if we really are unsatisfied with their approach or the seriousness of it, we will move away from that customer. We will exit customers. Now, you know, that sounds quite draconian and it doesn't mean we have to exit overnight, but we will move away. Now, without getting into names, but, you know, Mark and the team have made those calls today, and we have, and that's what's really shown in particular. You can see it on the thermal coal piece. You know, that didn't happen. That thermal coal reduction is not natural runoff. That is through active management of exiting, reducing, you know, walking away from customers that we don't feel meet our sense of purpose and what we're trying to achieve over time. So that's sort of at the high level. I don't know, Catherine, do you have anything to add to that in terms of measuring the impact of the decarbonisation?
Well, I guess, Jane, my comments would be to Alison's question about what are we thinking about going forward. You know, if you look at how we've structured up our $50 billion funding target, which is right across the three pillars of our purpose and aimed at capturing the activity that we're doing as we look forward to work with our customers around transitioning, whether it's from an environmental perspective or dealing with social issues and et cetera. And, you know, we're gearing up within Mark's business and institutional to be able to do that right across our capital markets team where it comes to green social sustainability bond issuance, across our advisory business where we're advising on renewables, in our greenfields and acquisition business where we're providing balance sheet to a range of renewable energy and infrastructure, and of course there's a sustainable finance part of the business that I run where we're looking broadly across that green social sustainability linked bond and loan. And you know, we're very focused on that. We've been focused on it for a number of years actually, and participating strongly in the market in terms of bringing opportunities to the market for our customers and also the investor community.
I mean, I think it's an interesting point. I mean, your point's a good one about measuring it, though. And just again, another observation. I mean, I guess there's a couple of ways we could have approached this. One would essentially be all about us, which says, oh, we'll just move, we'll just exit. And you might argue that that reduces supply of financing and that has some impact on the market. But if it just gets replaced by somebody else, well, we haven't really achieved anything as a community, right? So, and you know, let's not kid ourselves, there is still money available out there for thermal coal and other projects, maybe not as much as it used to be. We've taken a view that we actually focus on the bigger goal here, which is actually decarbonising the economy and the community. So we want to work with people to make real change, not just pat ourselves on the back because our exposure is down, but it just moved it somewhere else.
Well, look, and that is in part part of the reason for my question, because of course there's systemic risk.
Yeah.
Participate yeah. in that instance.
But I think you know, Mark, you know, what's been really interesting, and I haven't been as close to it as Mark has or his team or Catherine, but you know, the conversations with the people that we have had is, you know, by and large, very constructive.
Yep.
It's not like we're fighting a battle here with these customers. They actually do get it.
Yep.
You know, they're also looking for solutions and looking for assistance. I mean, there's always going to be a couple who don't, who are a bit laggards, and they're the ones that we just sort of move on from.
I'd also, I mean, and part of that, the conversation is, there's education both ways here. I'd have to emphasize.
Yeah, good point.
And, you know, so one of the things that we've done structurally in the bank is we've moved our resources, energy, infrastructure, relationship teams into our, what used to be our loans and specialist finance area, and we've now called it corporate finance. The reason we did that is we wanted that resources, energy, infrastructure team to be closely aligned to all the efforts we were doing in sustainable finance, and therefore have a natural transition transfer of knowledge around what was occurring in the markets for green bonds and green loans, where we saw opportunities for that market to continue to grow, and how some of these other companies could actually, how that could actually help them in their own transition. Now, they'll diversify their business, but the big part of this is also just understanding what's happening in the trends in the market. And we find that's only early days. We only just did that, Alison, in the last 4 months, but it's already starting to help with these conversations that we're having more generally. Alison, feel free to ask other questions. Go ahead.
Oh, I just was just follow up on that first scope for a more nuanced approach to oil and gas in the coming years, given you know,
it can be quite different. Yeah, again, I'll get Mark to answer, but I just think, you know, big picture here, again, we're not looking for a loophole. Oh, we look at us, we've done something on coal, but we'll just go about our merry lives everywhere else. No, I mean, we get it. We're just saying there's different stages here, and so the next stage will be, you know, as we've said, we do think gas has a role. That's not a unlimited, unmitigated role, you know. We're not going to push the boat out on gas, but we think there's a responsible way to bank the gas industry, albeit, as I said, in a controlled, limited way through this transition period. But Mark, do you just want to think
through that? I think that answers it pretty well. We haven't. You'll notice in the portfolio there, we haven't really grown as much at all. It's some FX movements in that 19 and 20 period for the oil and gas piece, but ultimately, now that we've sort of landed on where we are today, with particularly around coal, our next stage internally is to talk about how we want to position for some of these transition fuels. What does that mean? And how do we position, like we did with, to be honest, with coal. You know, these discussions and what we've seen in reduction in thermal coal exposure is a result of working with customers over the last 3 to 4 or 5 years. There was no surprises to them as we didn't do transactions or as we exited relationships. And we will look to take the same sort of lens to other exposures in the carbon intensive industry.
And I think the other point here is it is also, let's look on the other, it is about opportunity. We see massive opportunity in the renewables and sustainable side, right? I mean, you know, and we have, like, you know, we're a large organisation, I understand that, we've got a big balance sheet, but we also have limited resources, limited capital. You know, we want to put our capital to work in where there's actual real opportunity and growth, and we see that, you know, vastly superior opportunities there in the renewables and sustainable area, and we're really excited about that.
Great, thanks.
Thank you. A final reminder, if you'd like to ask a question, please press star then one. Our next question is from Brian Johnson of Jefferies. Please go ahead.
First off, congratulations on fantastic disclosure and a very noble aspiration. I've got a lot of questions, so perhaps I might just do three, and if there's time, I'll ask another three at the end. Can I just confirm that when we talk about limiting lending exposures, you're saying that you don't want to kind of like, you know, this is real and genuine. So if I had a conglomerate group that had a renewables business sitting within that group, would I not lend to it to just the renewables business within the group? Does that get around it? And also, does this include derivatives counterparty type risk?
It's a good question, Brian. It's about the detail on that. And again, I think the point here is we're not looking for loopholes. I guess there would be some examples in the ones that you have had. In terms of the derivatives, we're trying to talk about total exposures here. So, we're not trying to be cute and say it's lending only, but we'll do a whole bunch of other exposures. So we do mean total exposures. As you can imagine, as you know better than anyone though, that sometimes measuring those are a little bit harder. Well, it's not harder, but it can be a bit more misleading. They move around for all sorts of other reasons, but that's not our intent. So it is total exposure is the intent. And to your question, if you're asking, hey, if there was some hypothetical company who did both coal and, say, renewables, is there a way for us to continue to bank the renewable side of their business? Is that what you mean? Is that, yeah? Would that be...
Well, just, if we have a look at BP, for example,
yeah.
You've got a carbon-emitting industry, but I've also got a growing renewables business. I don't really know what the right answer is, but I'm just intrigued. Would you lend to just the renewables division of that, which is a noble aspiration, or is that seen as lending to the big evil carbon emitter?
No, I think we would, Brian, Mark here, we would look to lend directly to, if it was possible, depending on how the facilities are structured, directly to the sustainable piece. Without question, we'd be quite keen to do that, and we're doing that. If it was part of the conglomerate where you had other assets there of carbon, more carbon intensive, it would fall under that rule that we have around the 50% and with that moving to 25% by 2030. So that's the way we would approach it.
Okay. The next one is, if I have a look at slide 13, you talk about pricing. And we were talking before about the insurance industry has got data on everything. When we're talking about pricing, does that mean that you would tolerate a lower return on equity for shareholders on a renewable loan than you basically would a carbon-emitting loan?
I think a couple.
Like, it's socially, it's a great socially, it is a great aspiration, but I just want to get my head around that pricing and the return for shareholders.
Yeah.
No, I mean the short answer is no. We don't need to. Yeah. Now so when we think about pricing on a risk-adjusted basis, or the other way that we think about it, Brian, is to say we think that risk on the carbon side is much higher. So if you were to sort of stay in that business, the pricing you would need to price that risk would probably take you out of the market anyway, to be perfectly honest.
Yeah.
So no, we're not saying it's an either or. We're not saying we're doing it at the expense of shareholders.
No, and we'd want to be balancing it up. And I think the pricing of the facilities have sort of come together a bit over the last couple of years, particularly Brian. And remember, you know, the other thing that just is at the back of our mind is the conversation we have with the regulators offshore. You know, they're looking at the carbon intensity of loan books. So, you know, will they, you know, make it more expensive in a capital sense to be lending to these people over time?
I think probably.
I think that's probably the case.
Okay, the next question is what we can see is governments winding back on subsidies for renewals and companies like Telstra and Wesfarmers that you've spoken about. There was an article in The Australian that was recently quite critical of ANZ that basically the carbon kind of like restrictions don't apply to agriculture, but it was also talking about how you actually bought a lot of the carbon offset credits basically effectively came from India, where they were somewhat cheaper than if you get the equivalent in Australia. Shane, could we just get some response to that article, please? So the ag... And ag, oh, ag
yeah,
is a much bigger emitter of carbon than coal.
Yeah. I understand that. Yeah. So look, I think the outrage on that article is, you know, our policy got hijacked by, for political purposes, by certain members, certain people in Canberra, who,
yep,
when pushed from it, hadn't even read it, right? Who decided that they could score some points and, you know, rally the cause of farmers. So I got lots of angry letters from farmers. But, you know, the reality is when I spoke to them, and I did, and picked up the phone and spoke to some of those people, we can't all that down. This is not, this has got no direct impact on our relationship with the agricultural sector. You know, as one of our people said, you'd have to have a lot of cows to be in our top 100 emitting customers.
Yeah.
But nonetheless, but having said that, you're right. So yeah, there's not changing our risk appetite around farming. However, we're not ignorant of the fact that you are right, there is an issue, but our view is that actually the farming sector is actually generally pretty environmentally sensitive and pretty responsible. And again, our policy there is to work with them on long-term solutions. So that was sort of the response here. And again, I had a good engagement with various members of that community, and it reassured them we're not walking away from it. Now, they made the very reasonable point that farming sometimes is sort of at the end of the chain on this, if you will, you know, and bear the brunt of costs imposed on the sector, et cetera. And, you know, that's not our intention, and we're going to work with them, and we've said we'll do so constructively, and so we're going on that. The second point was the one about, what was it, Brian? The other part of the article was, offset. Hey, look.
Buying the offset credits from India as opposed to Australia.
Well, okay. So, well, we're an international firm, and, you know, we also have a responsibility to seek value for our shareholders. And so if we decide to buy offsets, surely we should buy them economically. I don't think there's an ethnic or a nationalist issue there. Having said that, the real answer is to move to 100% renewables, which is what we're doing. And so that's what we're going to move on, yeah.
Okay, I think that is actually the right answer. Jennifer, I can just push my luck with one final question. I was a bit surprised, and it kind of makes a lot of sense to see you talking about commercial real estate in here and buildings. Just on the building front, when you have a look at where carbon is emitted, the cement industry is a massive emitter of carbon. Like, it's 5% of the global carbon, which is just a massive number. So when we're talking about commercial real estate, are you talking about that you'll only finance basically new buildings that are incredibly energy efficient, or are you taking into account the amount of carbon that is basically produced as we build buildings with cement that basically use it? I just would like a little bit of clarity on that, and then I'll stop.
Yeah, no, it's a good question.
So in relation to the first half of the question, yes, the target, the funding target is in relation to new build commercial real estate. You're absolutely right in relation to cement and other sectors that are very high consumers of energy. And our plan is firstly to set out our targets in relation to commercial real estate and power generation, and then have another look at other large emitting sectors and make decisions about what sort of targets we can set around that.
Yeah.
So we understand the point entirely. We got at what we could get at, to be quite honest with you. We have good data on commercial property and power generation, so we're tackling that first, and then we'll make some decisions about future sectors.
And at the risk of putting my foot in it, my understanding from a previous project I did actually, In order to get those green star ratings on Buddha, the materials is part of that calculation.
Yeah,
so it is part of the calculation. Brian, they do look at that. So heavy usage of cement is actually a negative when calculating your green rating.
Yeah, Catherine, I don't know if you've got any. Can you add any heat on that because you're close to that?
Look, not the specifics of the energy ratings and how they're calculated. I just support what both Shane and Jared have said in that regard.
Yeah, I think the point there, Brian, it's not just about the energy efficiency of once it's built, it's not just the running cost, the bills piece does go into it.
Yeah.
Even down to things like, I know for this building actually, because our building here in Melbourne is about 6-star rated and we were one of the first. Even things like, do you provide, biking facilities for staff and all of those things, all contribute to the rating.
Okay, I might ask some questions at the end. Thank you very much.
Okay. You might
have apologies. Mr. Johnson has come back into the queue. Let me put him back in. Thank you.
Sure.
Mr. Johnson, please go ahead.
Okay. Shane, just three other questions, if I may. The first one is that we've got most countries in the world talking about 2050. We've got China talking 2060. You're a good corporate citizen. Our policy at the moment is the second half of this century. Does that become a problem?
You mean the government's policy?
Should ANZ be publicly lobbying the government to basically bring the number, or do you just stay out of the politics of it?
We stay out of the politics of it, because actually I don't, that would be helpful if there was that some sort of alignment, because, those sort of rally the cause and all that. I just see it as an old-fashioned business issue. I have a personal view that the private sector gets there faster. And as I said, our company's already moved. Our customers are voting with their wallets and their feet. They're already doing this. This is, and what's been interesting about the reaction we got in the paper, it's hardly that our policy's radical. I mean, I don't feel like we're out of step at all. I feel like we're just reflecting the reality of the situation. And one of the things that I found, we were chatting about this at our executive team, Brian, is just, and again, for those of us who've been around long enough, and including yourself, things change really fast, and it's really interesting to watch how things can bubble along for a period of time, and then you get these huge shifts in public opinion on things and what's suddenly acceptable or unacceptable. And I think we're at one of those points, and so I reckon the government will get there at some point, but we just plough on.
Alright, now Shane, my final question, and you got upset when I asked you this on the last ESG call.
That's alright.
On one hand, and I'm sure you've prepared for this and you know what it's going to be, on one hand there seems to be this gentle nudging of borrowers about how they should behave, but on the other hand, ANZ yourself as an equity investor have big stakes in AmBank and big stakes in Pattern Bank. Now, you can say that you've got one director, blah, 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 but it just seems to me that you've got, as an equity investor, if you're telling people how to lend their money, we should expect you guys to behave the same way as an equity investor. Could I just get a perspective on that, please?
Yeah, I'm not angry at that. I agree with you. I don't disagree with you at all. Now, the only thing I would say for those on the phone who may not know the history, Those equity investments go back a long time. They predate me. They predate Mike Smith, actually. So they were investments during the McFarlane era, which are a long period of time ago.
I was an equity analyst when both of them were made, and I can remember.
So we have to manage them as best we can. I think you're right, Brian. I don't disagree with you at all. I think we would be hypocritical if we sat here and said, well, we this is how we run our business, but we don't try to influence or share our perspective, just like the people on this call who are shareholders in the company express their views to us. It's a very, very important stakeholder group that we listen to. And I think Mark's earlier point was, it was as a result, I think one of, because this is always, many things, but one of the real sort of tipping points for this was his exposure with Kevin and that, talking to some of our European investors in particular. So yes, I think that's fair. And I will follow that up very specifically. The only thing, again, for those on the phone call, our governance rights at Pannon are relatively limited. So, until recently, we're not even allowed to vote our shares, so we don't actually have any governance rights really of any note. We're working on that, and AmBank is different, you're right, and we do have the ability to appoint a director, and we have 23.8% shareholding, and we will vote on that appropriately. But I agree with you.
Well, Shane, I've got to say, Shane, you can't in good faith be nudging borrowers. You're being nudged by equity investors. It just looks fundamentally contradictory.
I agree.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. That concludes our question and answer session. I'd like to hand the call back to Mr. Brown. Please go ahead.
Look, thank you very much, everyone. And look, there are a number of questions there about the 100 top emitters engagement strategy. And just to repeat it again, if you're looking for the further disclosure on that, page 34 in the annual report and page 42 in the ESG supplement, there's quite a lot of detail there in case studies. So thank you very much.